The first talk, and I apologize for starting late, but we'll make sure we'll get on schedule. It's my pleasure to introduce Stan Aoki, and he will tell us about the broad relevance of VE stars, and there's no better way to start a conference. So,
Thanks, Chris. Well, first of all, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure to work with the people. I work in massive stars, as many of you know. I was the chair of the active OB star meeting, working group, as well as the massive star working group, I think in sequence, one after the other. And I always felt it was kind of strange that we didn't have more interaction between people who work on massive stars and work on BE stars. So when Carol asked me to give this talk, I thought, well, let me try to emphasize a bigger picture about why BE stars are interesting as physical laboratories, and that's indeed the theme of the meeting, after all, that they're bright emissaries of interesting physics. But as I was preparing the talk, I realized that in order to talk about why they're interesting in a broader context, I really had to talk about what I consider to be the key issues, physical issues, for what makes BE stars what they are. And so a lot of this talk will be kind of a review of that, and I hope it won't be too much of a review for the people here, but I know there's probably people of various expertise, including students, and so I'll try to tie them together, but there's a lot of review stuff here, as well as just the broader relevance. So from my point of view as a theorist, you know, don't confuse me with facts, too many facts, right? The two things that you want to focus on is the fact that BE stars show these emission lines in H-alpha, which are in evidence for a circumstellar disk. And through much work over the many years, we realize this is probably a Keplerian disk. And but also we know that BE stars are probably the most rapid rotating of all non-degenerate stars. And so these two things are presumably tightly linked to each other. And so the key questions for BE star physics is, what makes the BE stars so rapidly rotating? What spins them up? How do they actually lose angular momentum? What eventually spins them down? What determines the boundaries of the BE star, the BE phenomenon? And then how close is material rotating on the star to the orbital velocity it would need to eject material into a disk? This ratio of the rotation velocity to the orbital velocity is the way I like to characterize it. There are many other ways to characterize this so-called critical rotation factor, including the rotation frequency. But in the very nice review by Rivinius et al., we learned that there's a very nice argument made that we should be thinking about it in terms of this physical ratio of rotation to orbit. And so how is the disk launched? How does it actually diffuse outward? And how is it dissipated? And the relevant physical processes for this are that there's a stellar wind, because BE stars are massive stars, and they're hot, and they have a radiation-driven stellar wind. They also exist in various stages of pulsation. They're observed to have pulsational phenomenology. They also are predicted to be unstable in various instability strips. There's a wild card here of what is the role of magnetic fields. And then binarity. BE stars are typically often in binary systems, wide binary systems, but maybe in the past they were a closer binary and there was interaction between the stars. So I see BE stars as emissaries, bright emissaries, for three things. Their stellar structure, and including the what happens when a star actually gets very close to critical rotation, what happens in terms of its oblateness and gravity darkening towards the equator, what happens to its non-real pulsations, is there differential rotation, is there mixing, is there convection in the, maybe various places where there's an enhanced opacity, for instance, in the iron bump, and does that result in a dynamo? Then there's the physics of disks. BE stars have decretion disks. They lose matter from the star, which is the opposite of this normal way in which we see disks, which are the much more common thing in astrophysics. But the thing is that BE stars can be watched over timescales of years to days, to hours to days, to weeks, to months, to years, to decades. And they can be monitored, the disk can be monitored in the optical. And so they're really great places to study the physics of disks and how matter is moved through a disk. And this comes to the issue of how is material transported through the disk through what's called viscosity. And the standard way to treat viscosity in disks is to invent this parameter alpha, which says viscosity should scale like the sound speed times the scale height of the disk. But the real way we think that angular momentum is transported in a disk is something called magnetorotational instability. And then there's the issue of, are the disks magnetized in the sense that there's a large-scale magnetic field threading the disk, or are they basically unmagnetized? And the evidence, I think, for BE stars is the former, that they're very much unmagnetized in large scale. So now there's the issue of binarity. What is the historical role of binarity in the BE phenomena? Was there mass exchange or tidal interaction or mergers, possibly? And now in massive stars, if you've been following massive stars, the discussion now is that you can't understand anything about massive stars if you don't study binarity. And so those of us who've lived in the world of single stars, because it's simpler, have to now start thinking about this issue. And in particular, there's a very nice review, a nice paper by Selma de Mink that I'll be talking about. And then there's the issue, the fact that the disk and the wind interact today with binary companions, and compact binary companions. This gives rise to X-rays and gamma rays even. People in my university are interested in BE stars only because they're four gamma ray sources that are BE stars, that are BE stars in a binary system. So first of all, let's look at this whole issue of the emission lines. The emission, the E in BE star stands for emission. That means emission in the Balmer lines, H alpha, H beta, etc. And then when you look in high resolution, the detailed spectra, you find that this line is split into two peaks. And the two peaks come from the fact that there's an orbiting disk going around the star, which is basically coming towards you, making this peak, and material going away from you, making that peak. And this integrates a disk of is orbiting the star. And I said, through careful work of interpreting the details of these profiles, we now know that these disks are probably in Keplerian orbit, or very near to it. Now, the puzzle of BE stars is that, unlike the easy-to-make disks when you have material collapsing onto a star and forming a star, for example, that BE stars are too old to be protostellar stars. As a matter of fact, the disks come and go on timescales of years. So they can't be like the original disk from the formation of the star. Now, that's contrasted to the Herbig AE BE stars, which are a different phenomena, which BE stars are linked to. Most BE stars are not in close binary systems, so there's not an accretion source there. And so they lack the outside source to fall into a disk. So disk must be launched from the matter. How do the BE stars do this? Well, first, among the puzzle pieces, of course, there's the fact that there's rapid rotation. And even going back to Struve, it just said, well, if a star rotates fast enough, it'll just eject a disk. But when we look at detail, we find that the disks rotation speeds are typically less than the orbital speed, and the launching speed to orbit is much bigger than the sound speed. And if this is true, then it's actually quite a problem to get material into the disk, or at least in principle, theoretically, it's a problem. But there's also a stellar wind in the disk, and might think, well, maybe this can lead to a wind-compressed disk, what's called a wind-compressed disk, a model by John Bjorkman and Joe Castanelli from several years ago. This model is now not thought to be the explanation, but it really did teach us a lot about what's needed to make a disk. And then there's the issue of whether maybe magnetic fields could help spin up the material into Keplerian orbit by forcing it to co-rotate out to a larger radius, out to some co-rotation radius. And then the possibility that there are pulsations can eject material. So let's first look at the issue of stellar rotation. This is a very nice diagram in a review article that I recommend strongly to anybody in this audience about rotation. I'm sorry, the rotation and binary interactions in massive stars in general. And basically, this is a picture of what a stellar structure models predict to be the orbital speed, the Keplerian orbital speed, just above the surface of the star as a function of mass, going all the way up to 80 solar masses, and age. Here's in units of going from zero age main sequence to the terminal age main sequence. And BE stars sort of live right in this domain. And so the canonical number I want you to keep in mind is that a typical orbital speed for a BE star is about 500 kilometers a second, maybe a little bit more than the orbital speed around the sun, which is about 420. It's because the mass is a little bit bigger, the mass over the radius is a little bit bigger. So now, in order to get material into orbit, if we think about this rotation fraction, rotation over orbit, what we need to do is launch material into orbit. It's 1 minus 500 is the speed that we need, 1 minus W. 500, where W is this ratio. And that means that then, if you think about the sound speed of being 25 kilometers a second, if this rotation, critical rotation, is less than 95% of critical, then you need to kick things into orbit with something that's greater than the sound speed. Now, the sound speed sort of characterizes the typical speed, or actually the energy, the sound speed squared characterizes the typical thermal energy that's at the surface of the star. And the orbital speed squared represents the energy you need to get into orbit. And what we're saying is that we need something that is actually more energy than we have available freely in the thermal energy of the gas. And so this is a real major constraint, how close to critical are. So how do we infer a rotation? So I teach a Fundamentals of Astrophysics course. I'm always trying to teach the students to think in simple graphical terms. And so they've made this little nice diagram with Adobe Illustrator. You have, that's supposed to be a spherical star. I don't know. But I guess in the translation, it got a little bit prolonged this way. But it's supposed to be spherical. And what's really cool about rigid body rotation is that the projected velocity along a strip on the rigidly rotating body is just a fixed velocity projected V sine I. And so that every strip of this of stellar surface translates to a strip in the broadened profile. And so the profile in principle, if you scale it properly, is just hemispherical. And indeed, here's some plots of different lines. I don't know which star this is for, but I took this from a paper by Rivi, but I'm not sure about the year. I have to say I kind of guessed the year, because when I did this, I put this in my notes for my class, and then I lost the reference, and I couldn't find it in the last minute. So Rivi will have to correct that year. But now what happens is that when a star really starts to rotate fast, it's no longer spherical. It's also not cigar-shaped the way it was on that screen. It's the other way. It's bloated up the other way, kind of like, you know. It gets sort of thick at the equator. And, of course, it doesn't show up that well in this diagram because of the screen sort of distorting things. But you can see that the star is getting more and more. And it turns out at critical rotation, the star actually ends up having, in a very simple model called the Roche potential model, has a radius that's 50% bigger at the equator than at the poles. But what also happens, according to von Zeipel, is that the flux gets diverted towards the poles because it's sort of easier for photons to get out over the poles. And so when we include that effect and we put that into the line profile, then we get this kind of thing where the equator is very dark and so it doesn't contribute much to the line profile. And so the line profile is actually narrower for critical rotation than you would expect. And so this effect has to be taken into account when you try to model. And this is a paper I forgot to reference you, Rich, sorry. This is Townsend et al. Guess who's one of the et al.'s. But anyway, the point about this is that as you make the rotation go faster and faster, this is actually taken out of this particular version of the plot was made for the review article by Ravinius et al. You see that the rotation broadens, but then when you get to very rapid rotation, it sort of flattens out, and that's because of this gravity darkening effect. And so the bottom line is that it's hard to infer rotation rates unless you do some really careful physics. One of the other things I forgot to point out is that here, the depth of this rotation absorption feature is only about 1 or 2%. That's because when you take a line that has a certain equivalent width, when it gets broadened, the equivalent width is preserved. And so you're spreading out the amount of absorption over a bigger and bigger Doppler shift, and that makes the thing very, very narrow, or very, very shallow. And so that's a really tough thing to actually infer rotation rates. It's much better if we could actually use interferometry to infer something, and that's starting to happen now in the modern era. This is the first example, Alpha Eridani, which is only a very weak BE star, and yet it's inferred to actually be rotating very close to critical, probably 95% of critical, and it's very oblate. And indeed, the way to break this degeneracy is to use different diagnostics. So here's a picture for something that's rotating at 62% and 90% of critical. You can see the stars become gravity darkening. And now if you can actually use different diagnostics, some of them are formed, the equivalent width is low at the equator for this diagnostic, but it's large for this diagnostic. So even though there's less photons coming from here, presumably this diagnostic will be broadened more than this. And so if you use that differential diagnostics. And so here are the rotation fractions that are inferred. And these are basically, there's Alpha Eridani. That's inferred because we know its orientation for interferometry. Then there are shell stars. You know the inclination by interferometry. And then there's this code called FastRote by, I think it's Fermat, which is supposedly taking into account this physics. And you can see that the bottom line is that BE stars are rotating fast, but they're not supposed to be rotating more than about 70-75% on the aggregate. There are a few fast rotators, but most of them cluster around 70-75% of critical. So this is a real issue, because now if we think of 70, say it's 75, so if we think 0.3 of W times 500, that's 150 kilometers per second launch speed. And that's six times the sound speed. That means the energy that you need to get into orbit is 36 times the energy that you have available to you in thermal energy of the interior of the stellar surface. So let's just think about, how do we actually deal with angular momentum in general? There's sort of three different domains: conservation of angular momentum, then there's the Keplerian orbit, conservation of angular momentum, V5, the azimuthal velocity just falls off like 1 over R. In Keplerian orbit, centrifugal force balancing gravity, V5 falls off like the square root of R. The angular momentum actually increases with radius. And rigid body rotation, you just have some rotation rate, everything, the rotation azimuth velocity just scales linearly, the angular momentum goes like the radius squared. And this applies basically to any kind of free fall, like infall or wind. This applies to basic Keplerian disk, and this applies to magnetospheres. So let's focus first on this issue, and let's consider the simple case of infall. So here's a simple problem that I give from my fundamentals of astrophysics class. You have a spherical cloud with a uniform distribution of gas. What joke does that remind you of? But anyway, you have a spherical cloud with a uniform distribution of gas rigidly rotating, and there's a mass, either the self-gravitation of the cloud or a mass at the center, depending on how carefully you want to be about the calculus you do. But if you don't have any rotation, everything just falls to the center and basically forms a star. But of course, we know that clouds are always rotating a little bit, and if you just characterize the rotation by this critical rotation, this ratio of the energy of rotation compared to gravity at the equator of the surface of the cloud, then this is just 0.1. And now what happens when the material falls down, it doesn't actually fall to the center. These parcels actually end up coming here. And of course, when they cross the equator, they collide with material from the other hemisphere because they're gas particles. If they were stars, they would just orbit through. So like the reason why we have a Milky Way galaxy that's flattened is because presumably the gas that's trying to orbit the galaxy is flattened when it cancels out its angular momentum at the equator. But if stars formed early in the galaxy, in a galaxy's formation, the stars just continue to orbit even if it's rotating, because they don't collide. So the key to making a disk is having gravitational collapse, angular momentum conservation, and collision that cancels out some of the energy at the equator. And if we increase the rotation speed, this disk just gets bigger and bigger. And there's the summary of what it looks like. And this is a problem you can have your students do. It's very simple. Indeed, you can even calculate what the distribution of mass should be from this collapsing cloud. And what you see is, of course, mass is concentrated towards the center. Most of the material falls towards the center. But the rotation, remember, this is all critical rotation. Everything in this. So this predicts that the star, when it gets to the center here, should be critically rotating. So if we just do a simulation of this. This is Dylan Key, my graduate student. He did a nice, one of the first projects he did was to do a simulation of this process with a finite gas temperature. And basically what you find is that material just collapses and makes a nice disk. And it's basically supported by gas pressure, so it sort of has an opening angle here. And then the outer edge, where there's no more material to have an angular momentum, there's a pressure gradient, and so material flows off the edge of the disk. So a very nice illustration of the physics of disks. Now the problem, and one of the key points is that this inevitably leads to something that's rotating very close to critical. And so if you believe the physics, simple physics, all stars should be critical and everything should be a BE star. And the sun should be rotating at critical. But of course that's not what we observe. We observe that stars are typically rotating less than critical. The sun is rotating very slowly because it's lost a lot of angular momentum in its solar wind. But even when the sun was zero age, it was slowly rotating. And so the reason it thought to explain for cool stars is that cool stars form magnetic fields very early in their formation due to the convection. And these magnetic fields basically block the accretion. And you get something called disk locking, where the material at some radius becomes locked to the rotation rate of the star. That Keplerian frequency there becomes rotated, because that's much further away from the star, and its Keplerian rotation frequency is much less than it would be at the surface, the star is locked to a very slow rotation. And this is thought to be the explanation, or one explanation, one possible explanation for why stars in general, cool stars, are very slow rotators. But one of the distinctions between cool stars and massive stars is that massive stars, even non-BE stars, are all pretty rapid rotators for the most part. And so presumably there's less of a role of this magnetic field in cool stars. Here's a nice MHD simulation by Romanova of this accretion process onto a magnetized surface. And we'll come back to the issue of magnetic fields in a minute. But let me move on to the next process, the next physical process, stellar winds, driven by line scattering of radiation. What happens now if we now just take, instead of infall, we make an outflow? In other words, what happens if we don't have a magnetic field, but we just use radiation as kind of an anti-gravity? It just changes the sign of gravity. Well, now the material will expand outward, conserving angular momentum, as it's shown in this very nice diagram from John Bjorkman. I think it's from his PhD thesis. And now the issue is, if you accelerate too quickly, because you're going to an expanding space instead of a contracting space, you'll just go out into hyperbolic orbit here. But if you push the way gravity very gently, the material inevitably will cross the equator, and you'll end up with what's called a wind compressed disk. So this was an idea put forward in the 90s by John and Joe Casanelli, John Bjorkman and Joe Casanelli. And I did some simulations of this. And indeed, when you turn on a radiation-driven wind, due to the assumptions that John made in his paper, you get a disk. And it looked like this was great. But the problem is that the disk, once you get to the equator, then the radiation can no longer act as anti-gravity because it self-shadows. It's too optically thick. And so you don't get any gravitational anti-gravity here, and material just ends up falling back onto the star. And so the disk basically leaks, either falls back on the star or moves outward in the stellar wind. And the bottom line is that you never get very high densities, and therefore you can't explain Keplerian disk. And there are other problems with this model, but we don't want to go into details. So what about possibly using magnetic fields as a way to spin up the disk? The way magnetic fields slow down the rotations of massive stars, maybe when you have an outflow, maybe they spin up the disk. And this was the idea put forward. Oops, sorry, I got a little too clever there. So this is the idea put forward by a paper by John Brown and Joe Casanelli called the magnetically torqued disk. And so the key idea here now is that you're having a rigid body rotation. So now we go back to our definition of the critical rotation fraction. It's just the rotation over the orbital speed, which is just represented by this equation. And now if you go out some distance in rigid body rotation, that's about minus two-thirds power of this parameter, you'll have a Keplerian co-rotation. You'll actually be in Keplerian orbit. And to ask yourself how far a magnetic field can maintain rigid body rotation, it's the Alfvén radius given by this parameter, this magnetic confinement parameter that was developed by myself and Asif Abdullah. And so here's a simulation that basically shows a case that's really optimal, where the Keplerian co-rotation radius is comparable to the Alfvén radius. And basically, the material really does rigidly rotate out on this closed loops lines. But what happens is that material eventually just leaks out. This Keplerian radius here is basically an unstable neutral point. And so material either falls back down or it flows outward. And you don't ever form a Keplerian disk. Here's an illustration that shows this process more rapidly. Basically, you can see the material flows outward, or it goes outward or inward. It doesn't actually stay in Keplerian orbit. You can't just shut off the magnetic field when you don't need it anymore. That's kind of the lesson. Magnetic fields have their own physics that they have to obey. And you can't just use them to torque things up to Keplerian orbit and then get rid of them. So that's kind of, you know, the point about this. So magnetic torches can't explain be a Keplerian disk. There's an unstable neutral point. The large-scale field destroys any Keplerian disk, indeed. Moreover, large-scale magnetic fields are not observed in BE stars, even in the 10%. Greg Wade will emphasize this. This is kind of opposite to the accretion onto magnetized stars, but you can make rigid disks. And I should say, small-scale fields could still be important for ejecting material into Keplerian orbit in this kind of process. Anyway, large-scale fields will make a rigidly rotating magnetosphere, and this is a good model for BP stars. There's one of my favorite slides, I still show this all the time, courtesy of Rich Townsend, of a rigidly rotating magnetosphere where the material is trapped by the magnetic field lines. And these magnetospheres, basically, they can have two characters. if the Alfvén radius is much less than the Kepler radius, then they basically, material just falls back down on the star in what's called a dynamical magnetosphere. Or they have, if the Alfvén radius is bigger than the Kepler radius, there's a region here where material is trapped and makes this rigidly rotating magnetosphere. And when we look at massive stars that have magnetic fields, we plot them on the ratio of the Alfvén radius to Kepler radius. Everything above line here is basically centrifugal magnetospheres. And everything below here is dynamical magnetospheres. And all the dynamical magnetospheres that show H alpha are all O stars. And that's because they have so much mass that even the material, when it's falling back down, is still bright enough to make H alpha. Whereas the rapidly rotating BP stars, these are rotating very close to critical. So what's the relationship of these and BE stars? That's one of the questions. How do they get to be BE stars that are basically huge magnetic fields, but we don't call them BE stars because they show a different kind of H alpha emission. They show a broader H alpha rotationally modulated emission. All right, so let's move on to stellar pulsation now. Many BE stars show non-radial pulsations with modes of order, with spherical harmonic M of order a few. A best example is some nice papers by Rivi and his collaborators, Stan Steffel and Dietrich Botta. And nowadays, in space-based photometry, we can make this diagram of variability on the upper part of the HR diagram. And the BE stars are very prominent in here. There's also the slowly pulsating B main sequence stars and the supergiants. LBVs are up here. But basically, BE stars are all observed to be variable photometrically. And what are the issues for pulsation? Well, first of all, what kind of mode is it? You can have what's called P mode, which are basically sound waves, or you can have G modes, which are basically water surface waves, like similar to water surface waves. But when you have a very rapidly rotating star, you can also have something called the Rossby, or the rotation mode, where the restoring force is the Coriolis force. And the pulsations can be radial or non-radial. It's helpful if you want to make a disk to make them non-radial. But they also can be prograde or retrograde. If you want them to actually eject material into orbit, it'd be helpful if the group velocity was in the prograde direction. But mostly they're observed to have retrograde phase velocity. Then you can have beating phenomena, as shown by this paper by Rivi, that basically seems to be related to the formation of ejecting material into the disk. If different modes are beating against each other, the amplitude goes up. Now the important thing, the important thing here is that the amplitude of BE of pulsations, let's see, actually, let me go down. The amplitude of the pulsations for pressure modes can never be bigger than the sound speed. But for G modes and Rossby modes, in principle, you can have modes have amplitude of velocity because they're organized structures large scale on the star. They could be actually faster than the sound speed. And this is important for ejecting material into orbit. And then you have the issue of whether maybe rotation itself can focus angular momentum towards the equator. So this is a simple model that we call the pulsationally driven orbital mass ejection. Dylan Key will actually mention more about this model, where you basically just put a pulsation, and then you basically find that material gets ejected into the disk. And to shut the pulsation off, the material just stays there in Keplerian orbit. OK, so let's move to disks now. Again, there's decretion versus accretion. And so this is a nice a movie from Atsuo Otsuki using SPH simulations with an alpha viscosity. I don't know what the actual value of the alpha was here, but basically the alpha parameterization of viscosity just says that once you eject material into orbit, the disk will sort of grow outward. And so the way I view it is that if you think about BE, the phenomena, from the point of view of the whole star, the stars are basically, as they evolve, if they start out with some rotation speed, and as the envelope attracts, as the envelope contracts, the stellar envelope, as the star goes from the main sequence, the core starts to contract, the moment of inertia goes down. And if the moment of inertia goes down, in order to conserve angular momentum, the star has to spin up. So if a star is actually born with some fraction of critical rotation that's near critical rotation but still below, what will happen is that it'll rotate faster and faster. And when it gets close to critical rotation, it has to get rid of that angular momentum. And so one way to look at it is that the the disk that we see in B stars is just a consequence of the B stars trying to shed their angular momentum. Now, the puzzle behind it is that they seem to shed their angular momentum when they're well below this critical critical velocity. At least that's what the observations seem to still be indicating, though I do still think we should have to look at that more carefully. And so from the point of view of maybe looking at it, that all the dynamical issues of getting material into orbit are kind of a detail, and that evolutionarily, once you spin a star up close to critical, as it evolves on the zero-age main sequence, as it'll evolve and inevitably will eject the disk, because it has to get rid of that excess angular momentum as its moment of inertia decreases. And indeed, you can just figure out that the total amount of mass that has to be ejected will just scale like the outer radius of the disk, wherever the disk is no longer viscously coupled. And that could be different for binary systems than it could be for single star systems or wide binary systems, that truncation, outer truncation radius. So there's this very nice paper by Alex Sarchioffi that looks at BE stars. So like I said, one of the things that I think makes BE stars such ideal laboratories is that things happen on timescales of of order months or days or years. And here's, I'll have to convert here, let's see, this is 500 days, so that's about a year. B star is perfectly happy. Its V-band magnitude of this star hasn't changed. And then all of a sudden, what happens is it goes down over timescale, really short timescale. And this has been successfully modeled by these curves here for just a viscous diffusion of shutting off whatever is maintaining this steady state disk. Somehow you shut off the disk, and then the disk decays. But the rate at which it decays depends on the viscosity. And the viscosity is parameterized by this alpha viscosity parameter. And alpha of 1 is pretty much the most you could expect for a physical model, because viscosity involves a speed and a length multiplied by each other. And the biggest length around is the scale height of the disk. And the biggest speed possible for something that could move convectively would be the sound speed. And so you're talking about really kind of the critical value for alpha equal to 1. You're talking about the maximum viscosity you could have. It tells you that BE stars seem to be very strongly viscous, the disk. And I think this is an incredibly important paper. I think I was the referee on this paper, if I recall. And I was just stunned by the fact that you could do this. But there's other ways you can actually get rid of mass from the disk. And I know that we've had some debates about this. John Bjorkman's probably sitting there rolling his eyes right now, because we've talked about this all the time. But we know that BE stars, when they're observed at the equator, as so-called shell stars, that they show very strong ultraviolet wind lines. Whereas when they look at the poles, their winds are relatively weak, because they're actually very low luminosity stars. Their winds are relatively weak. And I think the only explanation for this is that material is being ablated off of the disk. And so there's certainly matter being removed from the disk. And the question is, how important is this process when it compared to the other processes? Now let's think about formations of stars. When massive stars form, what stops them from accreting? What stops their accretion eventually? Well, I think one of the things that's going to stop their accretion is that eventually the radiation that's of the star that turns on here is going to start to blow away this disk. Why are there very few OE stars compared to BE stars? Why are OE stars, O stars are probably rapidly rotating too? Because it's very hard for them to form a disk, because the radiation ablates them. So on the inner side of the BE phenomena, on the hot side, I think radiation plays a very important role in controlling the BE phenomena. What controls it on the cool side, I don't quite know. That's more an issue of discussion. And as I was looking through the abstracts, I noted that there was very interesting papers at this meeting about the effect of metallicity on the frequency of BE stars, and also on how early you have, how many OE stars you have in the Magellanic Clouds, for example. And you would expect, when you have lower metallicity, you have a weaker line-driven wind, you get less ablation, the process can actually be less important for lower metallicity, and maybe it's easier to make a BE star or something like a BE star in another galaxy. So that's another example of the broader importance. So now we just come to this issue of this magnetorotational instability. It's probably one of the most fundamental problems in astrophysics today. How do material actually form viscous transport? the material that we see around stars is all what we call, we think of it as gas, but it's really a plasma. And so it's highly conducting, and especially around B stars, it's highly conducting. That means magnetic field lines are tied to the plasma. It's a question of who's boss. If the magnetic field is really strong, it can completely disrupt the disk. But if you had a weak magnetic field threading a Keplerian disk, say we just had radial magnetic fields here threading a disk that's in this plane, okay? Over time, the Keplerian shear will wrap it up. And you'll get a wrapped up magnetic field. And eventually that'll become turbulently unstable and it'll form small scale structures. And this is the essence of the so-called magnetorotational instability. Actually, the magnetorotational instability has some interesting dynamics that's slightly even more subtle. But it's well explained by a very simple model known as the spring model for MRI. And basically the idea is, imagine you have two orbiting particles that are orbiting around a central body, central mass. And these two particles are connected by a spring. Well, this particle here wants to go fast, it's actually moving slower in rotation frequency, right? Because the rotation frequency falls off at 1 over r to the minus 3 halves, right? Than this particle. So this particle is going to move ahead. And as it does, it's going to pull on this particle. And it's going to lose angular momentum and energy. Because of the spring, it'll lose angular momentum and energy, and it'll fall to a lower orbit. Whereas this particle will gain energy and angular momentum, so it'll move to a higher orbit. And you can see what will happen. Eventually, this leads to some kind of instability that grows. And you can actually work out the growth rate. It's a very nice review, a wiki article, that talks about this process. And you know, you can actually solve for the growth rate of the instability. The maximum growth rate turns out to be about 3/4 of the rotation frequency. So, now, what's this got to do with the price and T of China? What's this got to do with magnetic fields? The answer is that magnetic fields basically act a lot like springs. And so what happens is that it's an effective spring constant, which is given by the wave number of a perturbation times the alpha speed, because it's the tension of a magnetic field. And basically, when you do that, you get that you can just do the exact analog, and you can calculate what the critical rotation, what the critical value for this wave number would be to make. So let me just finish the final topic here, rotation of binarity. And like I said, there's this very nice paper by Selma Domingue, Norbert Langer et al. And the last sentence of it says that all early type BE stars result from binary interactions. It's possibility. Their results suggest that it's possible. And they show basically mass exchange systems where you get rotation speeds of hundreds, you know, really very, very high, right at the critical rotation velocity of the star. And so this is an issue that we need to think about. But moreover, as we say today, we actually see BE stars in binary systems with a collapsed companion. Presumably, that collapsed companion was from a more massive star that probably evolved first, dumped some matter onto the BE star, and then became a compact companion, which now we see is interacting with the BE disk as it orbits around the star. And this very nice simulation I stole from Atsuo, because he and I have been working together on this whole issue of how do you make gamma rays from BE binary systems. And the bottom line is that there's a lot of interesting physics, and people, there are whole communities of people who do high energy physics that are very interested in BE stars because of their role in BE X-ray and gamma ray binaries. So that's pretty much the overview that I've put together here. Again, there's three different areas in which I think BE stars provide that are basically emissaries, bright emissaries. They teach us about stellar structure as you get to critical rotation. In principle, if we study BE stars carefully enough, we can learn about the physics of ablation, gravity darkening, how non-radial pulsation, how pulsations behave on rapidly rotating stars, whether there's differential rotation. I didn't get a chance to talk about mixing, but many people, there's something called the Hunter diagram. I have a copy of it. Anybody wants to bring it up? There's an issue of whether there's convection that generates small-scale magnetic fields. And through a dynamo for the rapid rotation. Again, BE stars provide kind of a counterexample to accretion disks, which are one of the most important problems in astrophysics, is to understand accretion. They provide us a way to test the nature of viscosity and how it forms and how the magnetic rotational instability, how it behaves in a case where we know is unmagnetized in a large scale. We know very well from observations that BE stars have no large scale magnetic field. And so we can have study how viscosity behaves in that relatively simple regime rather than the more complex case where you have a threaded magnetic field accreting accretion onto a magnetized object. All right, maybe the magnetized object is more common or more important in general, but if we don't understand the simplest problem, how do we understand the more complicated one? So I think BE stars are giving us important clues about the physics of, and then finally, binarity, whether they're, what is the history of BE stars? The statistical properties, I mean, many of the abstracts when I was reading through the booklet are talking about the statistical properties of BE and whether they could actually be coming from binaries. All right, well, thanks. And so many of you know that when I've given this talk before, I always like to think about this issue of like, whether BE stars are really rocket science. And I also like to show this slide here. What would happen if the Earth were rotating at critical rotation? Rotation of the Earth right now is about 1,000 miles per hour. I guess you're in Canada now, I have to do this in kilometers, but 1,000 is a rounder number. If the day were only an hour and a half instead of 24, then we wouldn't have to have NASA. We wouldn't have to launch satellites from Cape Canaveral. We could just go to the equator and jump. And then, you know, there's this phrase, stop the world, I want to get off. Well, no, it's spin the world up, I want to get off, right? How fast was the Earth rotating? How fast was it spinning after the collision that made the moon? Think about that one. All right, thanks.
If you ask any questions to the organizers, just ask me if you can email the organizers the question after the fact so that we can keep track of it.
BE stars at UWO.ca.
Okay, questions for Stan.
Okay. So you showed that if you assume rigid body rotation, you can explain line profiles, and this assumption is used.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
Rigid body rotation gives you quite different line profiles than Keplerian rotation.
Okay,
rigid body rotation gives you profiles that basically exceed V sine I, which you cannot do with a Keplerian disk. And so there's very distinct differences between line profiles you get from BP stars. Why aren't the BP stars that show H alpha called BE stars? As I recall, there was a definition voted on or decided on by the working group or something that BE stars are main sequence stars that show at some time in their life H alpha emission. Well, BP stars that I showed on that diagram fit that definition. But when you look at them, they're clearly not the same as the BE phenomena. They have much broader lines. I think Rivi can expound on this better than I can. They have much broader lines and they rotationally modulate. It's very clearly distinctive. But and so you really need to have a Keplerian disk to explain the, what we call the BE stars. No, I'm talking about the Keplerian disks of the, I'm sorry, I misinterpreted your question.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about the emission lines.
No.
Oh, the absorption lines, yeah. Yeah, the absorption lines. The rigid body rotation with broadening makes a less broad line. Rigid body rotation with ablateness makes less broad line in gravity darkening.
And my question was,
I'm sorry.
Is there any other assumption we can make of the rotation of the star to explain some perhaps other observed parameters? What else? What's the alternative to the rigid body?
Well, the differential rotation. I mean, there's papers by the Japanese group, I think Sayo, I think Rich knows these better than I do, Lee and Sayo, where they talk about pulsations being focused towards the equator and actually making the equator rotate faster. After all, the sun rotates faster at the equator than it does at higher latitudes. So there's no reason why BE stars couldn't do the same. And this process would be, so I think if you were modeling BE stars, you might want to relax the assumption of rigid body rotation and put in differential rotation and see if perhaps that could give you stars that are rotating close to critical but at the equator. But then you have to figure out how you're going to treat the gravity darkening, because now that sort of violates this Roche potential model. So I'm sorry I misunderstood your question the first time, but I think it made a good point too.
Ando.
Okay. Thank you for the, yeah, yeah.
John.
Hi, Stan.
Hi.
I'm working it back.
Yeah, good.
So you were talking a little bit about the MRI.
Right.
As being an amplification, but mechanism.
Right.
Do you have any comments about the issue of whether or not we need a seed magnetic field in the disk for this to happen?
Well, I didn't comment on it in the talk because it's an open issue, but I think in the same way where the sun has a magnetic field that's wrapped around by differential rotation, you can just put the arbitrarily smallest fields you want in there, and eventually it'll wind up and make a, it'll, you know. So the answer is, I think it's how many angels dance on a head of a pin, right? I mean, it comes down to even the smallest scale field that you have, even the smallest field that you have, will eventually be wrapped around by differential rotation. So I personally don't, I would doubt it that there could be disks that are purely, that are plasma disks that are, say, that have a very high conductivity that could not have the MRI. Now, when we talk about planetary disks, that we have a new professor at our department, Sally Dodson Robinson, who works on star planet formation. And there, the key issue is, what is the conductivity? How much ionization is there in the disk? But even a small amount of ionization is enough to give you a coupling enough to force the MRI to occur. That's right. So once you have differential rotation, you would possibly. And I think the answer to that question, I didn't say very much about it, but I was expecting maybe Myron to jump on me when I said magnetic fields can't explain B stars. But you have.
You said large scale.
Large scale. And I think what I should really emphasize, I almost went back and edited my slide to make the point that I'm not arguing against small scale magnetic fields that might be important in the ejection process. And in particular for gamma casts and the stars like them, magnetic fields may be very important for explaining the flaring and so forth.
Since you invoked my name, let me just add.
Sure.
Vizhniak says that seed fields are vital to an MRI, as I know. But he says don't worry about them, they always exist.
That's what I would say. That's kind of the way I would say it. I think an angel dancing on the head of the pin is a better, more graphic way, but that's pretty much my point.
One last quick question.
Hey. Could you also comment the fact that we may also lose some matter along the rotational axis, along the polar axis?
Well, in accretion, that's a common process. That whole process of that X wind is that you end up getting a jet out the poles. But when you have decretion, I don't think there's much that will actually tend to give you a polar jet, again, because I don't think magnetic fields play an important role in large scale for making the disk. So there may be, of course, when you have the brighter photosphere, the brighter gravity darkened surface, you'll get a stronger mass loss out the poles. But when you look at most UV lines from polon stars, they're typically weaker than they are from the equator, and so my feeling is that you might have a bit of a stronger wind there, but you really get the strongest wind when you ablate material off of the disk, and so.
Well, thanks, Stan. Let's thank Stan.